From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Two starkly different and highly interlocking news stories broke this week. The first was the president's proposed 2020 budget, which would cut more than $7 billion from the Department of Education.
Apparently in there, the notion that they'll do away with subsidizing student loans, loan forgiveness, that kind of thing.
The proposal would eliminate a program created by President George W. Bush that forgives federal student loans for certain borrowers who go on to work in public service or for a nonprofit after they have made payments for 10 years.
Overall, the proposal would reduce college loan subsidies by $207 billion over 10 years. The consequence? More obstacles for the non-rich to get a college education. And then, meanwhile,
the college admissions bribery scandal rocking the nation. Actress Felicity Huffman leaving court, one of the dozens of high-powered celebrities, executives, and coaches accused of forging documents and photos, cheating on SATs, and bribing school officials to get their children into elite universities.
Holy hell. Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, Bribe Your Kid into Georgetown Edition. Jaw-dropping allegations on the obscene abuse of privilege for the purpose of giving your teen underachievers a leg up. And of course, these accusations concern only the criminal expression of elite advantage. The scandal has also called attention to the completely legal multi-billion dollar industry of test prep and college consulting that confers major advantages to the wealthy. This is the New York Times' Jennifer Medina on Thursday's The Daily podcast.
If you believe that education, and that a college education specifically, is the great equalizer or can be the great equalizer of our country, what this shows you is that system is completely broken.
Well, gosh, that's not the story we get from our leaders. They have another achievement narrative altogether.
Generations of patriots fought to keep America a land of opportunity, where anyone of any race, any religion, from any background can make it if they try.
Presidents and social studies teachers have been telling us that our whole lives. But as Nathan Robinson wrote in The Guardian this week, quote, "This scandal only begins to reveal the lies that sustain the American idea of meritocracy." Now that's cold water in the face. Meritocracy, after all, is a word that suggests innate fairness and reward for accomplishment, the opposite of class privilege, and seemingly the perfect expression of the American ideal of endless possibility. But reality sometimes lies hidden below the surface until turbulence pushes it into view. It's what geologists call uplift. This hour, without any pre-planning and based entirely on recent news, turns out to be all about uplift, how our current political turbulence is rapidly pushing not just problems, but also long-buried potential solutions to the surface. Shortly, we will dig deeply into economic and social policy, but we'll begin with a meditation on this week's fresh outcropping, the myth of meritocracy. Come to discover, the word that so seems to distill our equal opportunity values was originally coined as satire. This from British sociologist Michael Young's 1958 The Rise of Meritocracy, a dystopian novel lampooning the British educational system.
What Young said was that what we have now is not an aristocracy of birth, but a meritocracy of talent.
John Patrick Leary is the author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism, one of which is meritocracy.
The satirical point there is that merit is determined not by an accident of one's birth, as in an aristocratic title, but instead merit is determined by one's access to an educational institution, which one is able to attend because of an accident of one's birth. And so meritocracy is a combination of merit and aristocracy. And the point that Young was trying to make originally was that the meritocracy was a new form of aristocracy that hid the old class privileges behind a veneer of educational equality.
So even though it sounds egalitarian, after all, what could be fairer than to proceed based on your own skills, talent, experience, and so on, it in fact just creates a gigantic Venn overlap with old-fashioned aristocracy, because it was the old-fashioned aristocrats who really had access to the education that could confer your merit.
Yeah, and when you think about what merit means and how we measure it and how we assess it, we think about what college did you go to, how do you present yourself, what kind of voice do you use in public settings, what do you look like, what gender are you, what race are you. There are all these kinds of measures of merit that have nothing to do with one's talents or with one's skills. And even one's talents and skills are themselves, of course, determined by your access to places that you learn talents and skills. And so there's no way of defining merit that doesn't involve some kind of social inequality. As you say, it suggests a kind of, to use another popular metaphor, for an equal playing field.
So that you, based on your own merit, your own God-given talent, that determines success.
Regardless of where you start out in life, if you work hard, if you do it for the right reasons, you can succeed in the United States of America.
Education in this country is an opportunity for all who show both the skill, the talent, the intellect, and the energy and the desire to be educated. It's a meritocracy.
In which we all have a kind of equal chance to rise based on our talents.
All right, but once again, the word sounds really good. And maybe it was inevitable that in time it would be uttered not in satire, but absolutely without irony. When did it start to turn that way?
Well, I think it started to become very popular again in the 90s. That's my sense, that meritocracy was a way of celebrating a kind of technocratic ideal of good governance and popular participation without class privileges or inherited titles and so forth. But in Tony Blair's Britain, meritocracy was a big watchword of his administration.
And the new establishment, it's not a meritocracy. It's a power elite of money shifters, middlemen, speculators, people whose self-interest will always come before the national or the public interest.
And Michael Young, who coined the term originally, you know, was on to this and had something to say about the expropriation of the term by Tony Blair and the like. He said, ability of a conventional kind, which used to be distributed between the classes more or less at random, has become much more highly concentrated by the engine of education, which mm-hmm. seems to get us right to the nub of this week's dual outrages, the rigging of the game against people without means and for those with ridiculous amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. It's important when we think about meritocracy to remember that second half of the word, that it's an aristocracy based on a perceived demonstration of merit. It's not just a question of using the correct words or changing a vocabulary to describe the scandal, but the problem is even if you put aside all of the stuff that we've been talking about, meritocracy's original satirical meaning and how it's been forgotten and so on, what we are talking about when we talk about a meritocracy is a system of equal access that doesn't exist by any kind of reasonable measure, especially when we're talking about American higher education. So the college scandal that has erupted over the last week is a cheating scandal on one level. It's a scandal about parents and these kind of unsavory actors rigging in an illegal way the system of testing and so forth to get these privileged but apparently not very talented children into these elite schools. But it's better understood as a sort of flagrant example of the way that the college admission system works all the time rather than an example of the rules breaking down.
It seems to me that what you're describing is a word that is not only an illusion, but a kind of linguistic Potemkin village that obscures the ugly reality beneath it.
Yeah, you know, when we sort of assume that as a sort of bedrock principle, we tend not to interrogate whether it should be or whether it is, in fact, a lived reality for most people. You know, people often invoke the myth of meritocracy. That's a phrase you probably have heard a lot this week. There's actually sort of two myths. First, the myth that there is such a thing, and then the myth that the United States is committed to that imaginary thing in actual practice. And when we talk about a meritocracy, we're sort of assuming a national commitment to equality without really asking whether that commitment exists and without asking how we intend to preserve it. You know, after everybody's been indicted and after all of the prosecutions have gone forward, USC is still going to cost $70,000 a year or something. So the really big scandal here is not necessarily how college admissions work when people are cheating, but how it works when people aren't cheating.
John Pat, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
John Patrick Leary is a professor of English at Wayne State University and author of Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. Coming up, a daring voyage to utopia. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. There are some things people just say. The weatherman is always wrong. The commercials are better than the shows. Cats are arrogant. It's conventional wisdom, never challenged. And yet, altogether untrue. Except for the cat one. But there's another piece of conventional wisdom central to a debate that may be central to the 2020 election. It concerns universal health coverage, now commonly known as Medicare for All.
Medicare for All is unaffordable. It's not plausible.
It's not surprising that this is a key Fox News talking point. As we shall learn, socialized medicine has been a conservative bugaboo for a century. But according to Washington Post columnist Paul Waldman, the allegation of basic unaffordability has seeped, mainly unchallenged, into media coverage. And as the Democratic Party has lurched to the left, the electorate is being misled. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Help us with terms here, please. Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke, and others have said they support Medicare for All. Now, sometimes we hear the term single-payer coverage or universal coverage. Are they all talking about the same thing?
No, they're not. And over the course of the past year or so, some people started talking about single-payer, but it turned out that that wasn't really appropriate because it didn't really describe what many people were actually supporting. You do hear a lot of people say the words universal coverage, but Medicare for All has really been the thing that everyone has kind of hit upon, even if it doesn't necessarily accurately describe what they all stand for. But it has a real benefit. This really comes out of the experience of the Affordable Care Act, which was so difficult to explain, and in many ways was a real kind of traumatic experience for Democrats. They spent so much time trying to tell people what it really meant and what it involved, all the while they were dealing with misinformation about death panels.
There is a provision in there that anyone over the age of 74 has to go before what is effectively a death panel. No! Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
It's and the really nice thing about Medicare for All is that it's simple, just three words, and you don't have to explain it. Everybody knows what Medicare is. You just give Medicare to everyone, even if that's not exactly what you're doing.
You've declared that the press are botching the debate. How?
Well, whenever there's a new plan that some Democrat puts out, one of the first questions they get is,
you haven't proposed in your plan how this would be paid for, so how would you pay for it?
Yeah, thanks for the question.
So this, I should say, makes Democrats kind of perturbed because nobody ever asks how we're going to pay for the next year's military budget of $700 billion or whatever it is. Republicans very easily dismiss questions about how their tax cuts are going to be paid for. But since Democrats are the party that is supposed to be serious about policy, they always get asked, how are you going to pay for this? The trouble is that we miss kind of the most important part of the context of that affordability discussion. And that is what we're paying right now. In 2017, we in the United States spent $3.5 trillion on healthcare. It was about 18% of GDP. According to the most recent projections, we're probably going to spend about $50 trillion over the course of the next 10 years. That's what we're already spending. So if somebody comes up with a new plan and you say, well, this is going to cost $30
trillion. $30 trillion increase would be coming from Medicare for All. It is just not something that America can support.
How could we possibly afford that? You have to start from the place that if we do nothing, we're going to spend $50 trillion. When we look around the world, you know, the average highly developed country like ours spends about half of what we do, and they manage to afford it. So the idea that it's just sort of prima facie unaffordable just doesn't accord with the experience of the rest of the world.
And there's the parallel issue of the difference between expenditure and investment. The interstate highway system was expensive too, but it obviously was a huge boon to the economy. Is there any kind of corresponding economic benefit from a single-payer program or any kind of universal coverage that would pay large or even modest dividends down the road?
Well, it's an extremely complicated question, and you know, you need a team of healthcare economists to sort it all out. But sure, if you give everyone health coverage, then there are going to be new benefits, you know, say people who are going to be healthier and will be more productive. There also, we have to acknowledge, if we're going to make a massive new reform that puts a lot of people out of private insurance and gives them insurance through the government, there are actually going to be ways in which that entails some costs. Like, for instance, there are a couple of million people who work in the insurance industry. If insurers have a much smaller part to play in our healthcare system, then those people are going to have to find new jobs. It's an extremely complex system when you're talking about something that is almost a fifth of the United States economy. If you're going to overhaul it, there are going to be all kinds of ways that we get economic benefits and there are economic costs entailed. And I think that there are ways in which people, both on the right and the left, sometimes underestimate just what kind of a big deal it's going to be.
You mentioned potential lost insurance industry jobs. Now, Republicans and the right-wing media call everything that they don't like a job killer. Every bit of regulation.
The new rules on greenhouse gases could come at a very high cost, nearly a million lost jobs.
We need to end bailouts. We need to end too big to fail. We need to protect consumers. We need to bring derivatives out into the open.
We're going to bring John Boehner on next hour. He's already calling this idea jobs killer.
Every bit of legislation.
When he proposed a 30% minimum tax, it would be about as big a job killing proposal as any president has ever made.
In Seattle, the minimum wage hike went to $11 an hour in April, and that city loses 1,000 fast food jobs in May. Doesn't that destroy the whole rationale for this living wage?
And sure enough, they're saying that now.
You'll get rid of the employer-based healthcare system, which is a job incentive. So it's a job killer. It's giving an entitlement to people who maybe wanted to take a job because it gave them health insurance.
So is Medicare for all inevitably a job killer?
Oh, I don't think so at all. And especially if you think about how much employers now spend on healthcare for their employees, you know, in many cases, tens of thousands of dollars a year. If we move to a universal system, they're going to be able to take that money. They'll pay some more of it in taxes, but then there will probably be some surplus that they'll be able to either give back to their employees or invest. It's a really complicated question of exactly what the effects are going to be. And even if you have some very specific job losses that happen, say, in the insurance industry, that's probably going to be dwarfed by all the jobs that get created. But one of the things about the media discussion about these things is that you can have a small number of people who lose out in some kind of a transition, and they can take on an outsized importance. We saw that with the Affordable Care Act. You might remember, you know, Barack Obama said,
if you like the plan you have, you can keep it. If you like the doctor you have, you can keep your doctor too.
And it turned out that once the new regulations on minimum benefits were imposed, there were a group of people who had kind of bare bones policies who got letters from their insurance companies saying, this policy doesn't exist anymore, and now we're going to give you something new. That number was pretty small, but it was a huge controversy. It blanketed the media for weeks.
Kevin McCarthy of Thousand Oaks, California, grew angry last spring when he learned that his family doctor of 14 years did not accept the Blue Shield insurance he'd purchased under Obamacare.
And we were like outraged. We're like
outraged because when McCarthy shopped for his policy, Blue Shield confirmed that his doctor was covered.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were duped.
And just the fact that there were sort of identifiable people who lost out, whose stories you could tell, made it a big media issue. And that's the thing I think that we have to understand. Anytime we're going to do something big and have some kind of big reform, there are going to be some people who lose out, even if the vast majority of people end up better off. Those people who lose are likely to really be featured in the media discussion, especially since Republicans are going to have an incentive to, you know, lift them up and point to them and try to get the press to pay attention to them.
So when Democrats say that private coverage may be kept as an option, that it isn't necessarily going to be single payer where the government is the only insurer, should we take them at their word? And I don't ask that for no reason, because last month, Senator and presidential candidate Kamala Harris was talking about gutting any vestiges of the current system.
So for people out there who like their insurance, they don't get to keep it?
Well, listen, the idea is that everyone gets access to medical care. And you don't have to go through the process of going through an insurance company, having them give you approval, going through the paperwork, all of the delay that may require. Who of us has not had that situation where you got to wait for approval and the doctor says, well, I don't know if your insurance company is going to cover this? Let's eliminate all of that. Let's move on.
Her staff, the next day, I think, walked that back and said, well, that's just one of the options. Right now, Sanders is the only one of the presidential candidates who has put out a specific plan. In his plan, there is no role, ultimately, for private insurance. If we look around the world, even the most socialized system in Great Britain has a small role for private insurance. They have private insurers in Canada, which is a single-payer system. There are hybrid systems like in France where there's kind of a basic Medicaid-like plan that covers everyone, and then people buy supplemental private insurance. I think we're going to see a lot of the presidential candidates ultimately find their way to something that expands Medicare and or Medicaid and gives people the option to join a government plan if they want to, but still has private insurance for people who don't want to, at least in some sort of long transition period. And the reason is, I think they're very, very aware that people are afraid of change and that it's easy to frighten people by saying that what you have now is going to be taken away, even if what you have now may be kind of mediocre.
All right. So you've explained the world as it exists. Now, if you would just spend the remaining moments of this interview telling us what's going to happen.
I wish I knew what's going to happen. Well, right now, there is a real hunger in the Democratic Party for ambitious change, especially on the issue of healthcare. You know, the experience of the Affordable Care Act, I think, was really traumatic for Democrats in a particular way. The bill finally got passed by the skin of its teeth, and then it had to withstand all these kind of legal challenges and ultimately an effort by the Republican Congress to repeal it. And after all that, the feeling in the Democratic Party is we don't want to go through that again. I think Democrats believe that if they get their preferred universal system, it will quickly become beloved by all Americans, and then Republicans won't be able to undo it even if they want to. The only trouble with that is that there is going to be a painful transition to whatever the system is, whether it's total single payer or some kind of modified public-private system. The transition will not be easy, and there may even be some short-term pain. And that's going to give Republicans a window to say, we should just get rid of this and go back to the way things used to be.
Well, Paul, thank you.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is an opinion writer for The Washington Post's Plumline blog. It's not as though universal coverage is some brand new radical idea. Never mind other countries. Long ago, the United States was this close to adopting it until a counterassault killed the plan. Jill Quadagno, author of One Nation Uninsured, Why the U.S. Has No National Health Insurance, told us in 2017 that the history of single-payer proposals is the history of scorched-earth lobbying and PR campaigns designed to thwart them.
Really, it goes back 100 years.
In the 1910s, proposed state laws for government health care, chiefly those in New York and California, were getting attention. But the proposals came from the wrong sort.
There were immigrants from Hungary and from Germany, many of them Jewish immigrants, who brought with them socialist ideas. Some of the labor unions had socialist orientations. This was considered a threat.
In the lead-up to World War I, the fight for national health insurance also was caught up in the fear of corrupting our way of life.
When the bill for New York began to make headway, officers of the New York Medical Society called it un-American, not democratic. Their leader said it represented the first step towards state socialism. And so that was really the beginning of this theme that health insurance is socialism. During the New Deal, President Roosevelt had considered including national health insurance in the Social Security Act of 1935, but there was opposition from the American Medical Association in particular that were very vocal about it. and he was not willing to risk losing Social Security for national health insurance, and so he took that out of the bill.
President Truman took up the mantle, and he was famously persistent in trying to achieve single payer.
Most of our people cannot afford to pay for the care they need. I have often and strongly urged that this condition demands a national health program.
In fact, when President Johnson finally signed Medicare and Medicaid into law, he credited Harry Truman.
He had been a judge in a small town. He had seen many of his clients who were sick and poor and couldn't pay for health care. So he had both a personal interest and then a politician's interest in what he thought might be a popular and winning campaign slogan, health insurance for all.
Our ultimate aim must be a comprehensive insurance system to protect all our people equally against insecurity and ill health.
Republicans were very much opposed to the Social Security Act, which they saw as a government takeover.
In the midst of a red scare in which everything that looked pink would stink.
If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist.
That was right before McCarthy began his hearings. Socialism, fascism, Nazism. The American Medical Association has local chapters of physicians in every town who controlled access to hospitals. So if you lost your membership in the AMA, you could be banned from practicing in hospitals. So they had a powerful weapon at their hand to become this huge lobbying force against national health insurance.
In the United States, we're frightened about socialized medicine, and our medical profession is going to do everything possible to prevent the government, the federal government, taking over medicine.
They hired a PR firm called Whitaker and Baxter to devise a campaign against Truman's plan. That included speeches doctors could give in their towns, literature that they could hand out to patients. And so the hospitals and doctors' offices and nurses and dentists became very involved in the fight against national health insurance. But beneath what was visible were the activities of the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, and other business groups giving money, supporting candidates. And so many Democratic senators lost their seats for supporting national health insurance. It died a death in the 40s and was not really revived until Clinton, I would say.
Now, the nominal argument by the AMA against national health insurance, as people continue to argue today, is that the government would get between your personal relationship with your doctor and your own agency over your own health.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. Today, the relationship between patient and doctor in this country is something to be envied anyplace. The privacy, the care that is given to a person, the right to choose a doctor, the right to go from one doctor to the other.
But it was never really about that, was it? It was about how much the docs were going to get paid.
Doctors were opposed because they were afraid that if there was a third-party payer involved, that it might take over control of doctors' charges and doctors' practices, which is, of course, what's happened anyway over the last century.
As it turned out, doctors did very well by Medicare. And by the time the Clintons in the early 90s were working on their health care policy, the interference was less from the AMA than the insurance companies themselves, who got together and funded, among other things, this notorious ad that came to be known as Harry and Louise.
This was covered under our old plan.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Things are changing, and not all for the better. The government may force us to pick from a few health care plans designed by government bureaucrats.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
Yeah, they choose.
We lose.
And the Harry and Louise ads echoed a theme that began really in the 1930s, the idea that the government would take over your health insurance and would destroy the doctor-patient relationship.
It's a common sense approach that restores the sacred doctor-patient relationship.
And respect for the doctor-patient relationship.
And returns the relationship between a patient and his or her doctor without the government being in the middle.
What about the hitherto all-powerful epithet, socialized medicine?
You know, that comes and goes in waves, and so I think it will always be a part of American politics. But we find that the younger you are, the more likely you are to support government-provided health care for everyone. For younger people, their whole lives, Medicare has been there. Medicaid has expanded enormously. Medicaid is now almost as popular as Medicare, and so that idea now is resonating with the public much more than the idea that the government doesn't have any responsibility and has to get out of the healthcare system completely. People just don't buy that anymore.
Jill, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Jill Quadagno is the author of One Nation Uninsured, Why the U.S. Has No National Health Insurance. She is also Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Florida State University. Coming up, free money for everyone. No, seriously, this is on the media. This is on the media. I'm Bob Garfield. The president's proposed 2020 budget has been sent to Congress, and with it, no surprises.
Now, President Donald Trump's $4.7 trillion budget proposal calls for cuts to Medicare and Medicaid.
Food stamps would be cut by a third. The EPA budget would be cut by nearly one third. And funding for UNICEF, among other programs, would be eliminated.
All in all, a full-on assault on the most vulnerable Americans, couched in the language of moral superiority. The rhetoric is hardly an invention of Trump world. It also guided the thinking of Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, whose center-left triangulation politics yielded strangulation policies, especially for the urban poor. But that was then, and this is now. In 2019, Trumpism is faced with a stark counter-narrative. The Democratic sweep of the House of Representatives and the crowded field of presidential candidates have put some policies on the table that even a few years ago lived only in the nightmares of right-wing Cassandras. Medicare for All, Green New Deal, and now, believe it or not, universal basic income.
The freedom dividend. Simply put, every American adult gets $1,000 a month, free and clear, no questions asked, to do whatever you want.
UBI, also known as free money, the explicit expansion of the welfare state based not on Marxist theory, but on data, experimentation, and economic reason. And you may well recognize one of its biggest proponents because he's not only a journalist, author, and economic philosopher, he's a meme.
And you're all like, oh, I'm against the globalist elite, blah, blah, blah. It's not very convincing, to be honest.
Why don't you go f*** yourself, you tiny brain, and I hope this gets picked up, because you're a moron. I tried to give you a hearing, but you were too f***ing annoying for me.
You can't handle the criticism, can you?
Yes, that's the confrontation between Fox News host Tucker Carlson and Rutger Bregman, author of Utopia for Realists. Carlson invited Bregman for having had the audacity to call out World Economic Forum billionaires in Davos for the hypocrisy of their liberal rhetoric. But the little Tucker got a little more than he bargained for, and we all got introduced to a loud proponent of universal basic income. Rutger, welcome to the Not Tucker Carlson Show.
It's great to be here.
Okay, you're not new to the utopia space. Mm-hmm. Your book was published in 2014, but you were kind of under the radar here until Davos.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
During the conference, I became more and more uncomfortable with the idea of just promoting my book and not saying something about the extraordinary hypocrisy of the whole conference, because everyone was talking about all sorts of wonderful ideas like feminism and participation, equality, but no one was talking about taxes.
From your perspective, they were avoiding the central problem of global society.
Exactly. And I got so much pushback when I started raising the idea of higher taxes, that we should do something about tax avoidance. These people often use philanthropy as a way to distract people from the real issues, right? They have all these wonderful plans about, oh, I'm doing something with girls' education in Uganda. And I'm not against that. But pay your taxes first, please.
And you're speaking of progressive taxes with very high marginal tax rates, what conservatives, and I guess your audience at Davos, would call confiscatory taxes.
Yes, exactly. Just as we had in the 50s. So under Republican President Eisenhower, for example, the top marginal tax rate in this country for billionaires was 90%. The estate tax was over 70%. This was the case around the developed world. It's only since the 70s and the 80s that tax rates have gone down and down and down, and inequality has grown and grown and grown. So it's really about going back to an older tradition.
Now, Rutger, if you did not exist, conservatives would have to invent you, because your proposals represent the very nanny state, big government, welfare queen nourishing society that they have been screaming about for 50 years. Government handouts, open borders, 15-hour work week, and, you know, probably trees overflowing with gumdrops. Now, your book lays this all out very succinctly, but would you please explain why you are not, in addition to a bogeyman for the right, an actual commie lunatic?
I really think that the idea of a universal basic income is the perfect marriage between progressive and conservative thinking, between the left and the right. So what the left gets is obviously the eradication of poverty, a pretty good thing in itself. Now, what the right gets is a much smaller state in terms of paternalism. The traditional left always wants to help people to make better decisions, right? To put them in all these kind of programs. My idea is that poverty is not a lack of character, but just a lack of cash. And if you just give people the means to make their own choices, give them the freedom, then they'll have some venture capital and they can move on to a different job, start a new company, move to a different city, which will unleash a lot of dynamism and energy in the economy. So actually, I think that a universal basic income would be the crowning achievement of capitalism.
And the evidence suggests, you write, that, you know, contrary to the axiom that rather than giving someone fish, it's better to teach them to fish, you're saying, no, give them the fish. In fact, give them the cash and let them buy their own damn fish.
Yeah. There have been fascinating experiments in the 70s in this country where, you know, thousands of families received a guaranteed basic income. And the researchers just tracked what happened and tried to find out whether, you know, people use this money in a good way, whether they stop working. And time again, what the scientists have found is that healthcare costs go down, crime goes down, kids do much better in school. And this is really an investment that pays for itself. There's a wonderful study that's been going on in North Carolina for years now, since the early 90s, where there's the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians that started operating a casino there. And they give out all the earnings of the casino to the members of the band, which has pulled a lot of people out of poverty. And what researchers have found out is that actually the reductions in terms of lower healthcare costs, lower crime rates, are bigger than the cash grants themselves. So in that sense, this is literally free money. It's an investment that pays for itself.
You're not all alone in discussing this.
We should explore ideas like universal basic income to make sure that everyone has a cushion to try new ideas.
And I think ultimately we will have to have some kind of universal basic income.
Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, and others have raised the notion of universal basic income. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of jaw-dropping fact that there was another big booster of free money. And that was...
The present welfare system has to be judged a colossal failure.
Richard Nixon.
Nixon.
Yeah.
Tell me.
So you have to know that at the end of the 60s, almost all the experts believed that some form of guaranteed basic income was going to be implemented. It was a hugely popular idea back in the day. So in the early 70s, Nixon thought, okay, well, if everyone is in favor of this, you know what? I'll be the president that implements it.
And that is why tonight I therefore propose that we abolish the present welfare system and that we adopt in its place a new family assistance system.
So he had a bill for a modest basic income that went through the House of Representatives twice.
For a family of four now on welfare, with no outside income, the basic federal payment would be $1,600 a year.
And was only killed in the Senate by Democrats, actually, not because they didn't like the idea of a basic income for everyone, but because they wanted a higher basic income. So it's a terrible, terrible irony that it didn't happen back then.
It's just hard for me to get my head around the idea that it was that close. Now, by the time it failed in the Senate, Nixon himself had already been sort of moved off of the idea because he had learned a historical argument against universal basic income, I think from 19th century England.
So what happened in the early 19th century is that there was a small program called the Spean-Amanent system where certain British towns tried to do something about poverty. It was sort of the first basic income-ish program. And back then, in 1834, there was a report written by the English government where researchers were very, very critical of this program. You know, they wrote thousands of pages how this basic income had made the poor too dependent, too lazy, marriages had broken down, and, you know, that it was basically a total disaster. Now, fast forward 150 years, Nixon is thinking about, do I want to implement this basic income? And am I enthusiastic about that? And then one of his advisors, a guy named Martin Anderson, who was a huge fan of people like Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman, he put forward that it had been a disaster back then. So that more or less convinced Nixon to change his rhetoric.
And for the first time, benefits would be scaled in such a way that it would always pay to work. With such incentives, most recipients who can work will want to work. This is part of the American character.
To, you know, talk about workfare instead of welfare and start talking about the lazy poor, etc. What he didn't know is that actually this whole report that was made in the 1830s by government so-called scientists was actually a hoax. That's what historians later found out in the 60s and the 70s, is that all of the evidence was just made up, basically, and that in reality, it was quite a successful program. It's a grave example of how contingent history sometimes can be, and that it's not governed by big laws, but that sometimes small things can make a huge difference.
Just to be clear, you're not saying that people will live entirely on their universal basic income. No, the data suggests that once they have that, their instinct is not to work less, but to work more.
The basic income is really a floor on which you can always stand. You can always fall back on it. In all these experiments that happened around the globe since the 1970s, is that people sometimes do a little bit less paid work, like 3-4%. You see very small reductions. But this is always compensated by people doing more volunteers work, caring for their kids, caring for the elderly, or maybe start a new company or something like that.
All right. So once again, if we'd been having this conversation even, I don't know, 2 years ago, people would think that you and I had both taken leave of our senses.
Yeah.
But holy moly, maybe your time has come. The Overton window seems to have cracked open a little bit. What's changed to make these proposals even thinkable? Why are you all of a sudden not such a marginal figure?
Well, there's a great saying in science. Science progresses one funeral at a time. And I sometimes have the feeling that the same is true for politics. So I'm part of a generation that was born just before or after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We're not traumatized by the Cold War. We don't look at the world in terms of, oh, this is capitalism versus socialism. And like the standard responses that you always get is, oh, that sounds like communism, that sounds like Venezuela. That doesn't work anymore. We say whatever, because we see the huge challenges that lie ahead. Climate change, income inequality spiraling out of control. So I guess it's just really a new generation that is desperate for new ideas and doesn't only want to know what it's against, but also wants something to be actually for.
There was this moment in your confrontation with Tucker Carlson that he expressed incredulity that you were even familiar with Fox. And I think you told him that you have the internet in the Netherlands. It kind of makes me wonder how the partisan, increasingly polemical media world we're living in now affects this debate and affect your chances of actually seeing the kind of progress you want to see.
Well, I thought for a long time about whether I wanted to release this recording of the Tucker Carlson interview, yes or no. In the end, why I decided to do it was simply because it would ensure that we'd be talking about the right things for a couple of days, right? There would be a lot of oxygen going to talking about taxes and taxation and inequality. What I realized at that point is that releasing the video, yes or no, it's really a matter of, yeah, what's your deep philosophy of how political change works? You know, do you believe that people need to get together and have this constructive conversation? Or do you believe that sometimes you need to just aggressively put forward certain issues? And normally I would prefer the former, but I'm afraid we live in a world now that sometimes you just need to use the latter strategy.
Gigantic shifts, I would say tectonic shifts in economic policy and the role of government tend to happen over long periods of time after being battled out by think tanks in the media and lots of failed legislation and so on. But then there was, you know, same-sex marriage, which kind of came from nowhere to become the law of the land in just a few years.
Exactly, exactly.
Does the zeitgeist offer you an opportunity to affect change that otherwise would have been glacial in its evolution?
My take on history is that if you zoom out a little bit, you see that every milestone of civilization was once a utopian fantasy. So as Oscar Wilde once wrote at the end of the 19th century, progress is the realization of utopias. Democracy was once a crazy idea. The end of slavery was once dismissed as, oh, that's never going to happen. The welfare state was once seen as a bizarre, unreasonable idea. So I'm really interested in those people who are at the fringes of the debate and who are being dismissed. And then they start moving towards the center. But it works in both directions. If you look at the history of the 20th century, take the 50s, for example, what you see is that there was a small group of thinkers who called themselves neoliberals, like Milton Friedman and the Austrian philosopher Friedrich von Hayek. And they gathered in this place called Mont Pelerin in Switzerland. And they said to themselves, we're in the minority right now. I mean, we're the radicals. Everyone has become a socialist. Everyone believes in big government these days. But what we need to do is to start developing our ideas, building our networks, our think tanks, our institutions. And this will take years and years and years. But our moment will come. There will be a crisis in the future. And then we got to take the stage. And this is exactly what happened in the 70s. So if you want to know where Reagan and Thatcher came from, you got to go back to the 50s because they just got their ideas from people like Friedman and von Hayek. And that's what is happening right now. If you want to understand AOC, well, you got to do a good historical research into all the ideas that she's now advocating because it didn't come out of nowhere.
Rutger, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Journalist and economic historian Rutger Bregman is the author of Utopia for Realists, and Tucker Carlson doesn't like him.
Very true.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield. And hey, wanted to hear about the lost hate speech of Tucker Carlson that blew up this week? Check out the website, onthemedia.org.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.